From the Watson Institute at Brown University, this is Trending Globally. I'm Sarah Baldwin. This episode is a special co-production between the Watson Institute's China Initiative and the Center for Middle East Studies at Brown. The center is housed at the Watson Institute, and this semester we're thrilled to highlight some of the scholars and guests who are a part of it. This past fall, Adib Khalid, Director of Middle East Studies at Carleton College, was invited to Watson to discuss a humanitarian crisis that many of us in the West are just beginning to notice: the Chinese persecution of the Uyghur population in northwest China.
More than 400 pages of leaked Communist Party documents detail the mass incarceration of mostly Muslim Uyghurs and other minorities.
I've talked to a lot of exiled Uyghurs. They say that these camps are meant to eradicate their ethnic identity.
China calls them thought transformation camps.
Mass surveillance, child separation, concentration camps. The more news finds its way out from this heavily policed part of the world, the clearer it becomes that the Uyghur people are facing an existential threat. But as Khalid made clear, this is just the latest turn in a long and complicated relationship. I talked with Khalid about how this Muslim minority ended up as part of China in the first place, and how their persecution fits into China's efforts to consolidate power in the 21st century. We also talked about how China's economic development plan, known as the Belt and Road Initiative, might be connected to the tension we're seeing today. Adib, thank you so much for coming in and talking to Trending Globally today.
My pleasure.
The Chinese government has detained between 1 and 2 million people from the predominantly Muslim Turkic minorities. Mm-hmm. Uyghurs, Kazakhs, Kyrgyz, in political re-education camps, which they now are calling vocational training centers.
Right.
And that's in the northwest region of China called Xinjiang. The Chinese government says the centers are meant to steer people away from extremism. But before we go any farther, I wondered if you could just give us some background on just who the Uyghurs are. What's a Muslim Turkic population doing in China?
I think I would turn the question around and ask, what is China doing in a predominantly Muslim Turkic region? Because in some ways, that is the crux of the matter. That the province we call Xinjiang today, which is a Chinese term imposed on it after its conquest by the Chinese in the 18th century. The Qing, which is, there's a side story there that the Qing were actually not Chinese themselves, they're Manchus. And they had established an empire of conquest, of which we have numerous examples in the history of Eurasia. And one of the places they had conquered was China itself. And so the Uyghurs were brought into a state called China by the Manchus. And I'm myself am a historian of Central Asia, and I'm currently writing a book on Central Asia in the modern age. Most of the time when we think of Central Asia, we think of the former Soviet republics that came out of that. But what is now Xinjiang is linked to a deep cultural, religious, and ethnic ties with what was Soviet Central Asia. It's basically a single cultural and political region that was divided up in beginning from the late 18th century by two neighboring land-based empires, those of the Qing and those of the Russians. And so in some ways, the question really is, well, how does China get to be an actor in Xinjiang? As a Central Asian historian, I would like to put the question that way. The Chinese state has very strong feelings on that China is a single nation state, indivisible, with an inviolable territory.
But can I just ask a question about that? In the early decades of communism in China and the People's Republic,
right,
and even during the Qin Dynasty, wasn't there a slightly more enlightened way of governing that allowed for differences?
Absolutely. So in some ways, it's a question of the management of ethnic and national difference in these multinational empires. And the Qing were actually not at all assimilationist, and they ruled Xinjiang with a very light hand, in the sense of having a military government that was manned mostly by Manchu and Mongol warrior elites, but with a great deal of incorporation of local Muslim nobility, and who really acted as intermediaries. And up until the turn of the 20th century, central rule was very mild and very distant. Mm-hmm. And so when the Qing were toppled in 1911-1912, Han Chinese nationalists were very happy to see them go, but they were less happy to let the empire that the Qing had built go. And that included Mongolia, Tibet, Xinjiang. And these were all areas that were brought into the Chinese state by the Qing over the course of the 18th century. And so they came up with various ways of justifying and explaining or legitimizing China as a single inalienable state. And initially, in the 1910s and 20s, under Sun Yat-sen, the idea was that China was a union of five races. And at that time, race and nationality, man, they're intertwined. And so was the Han, the Manchu, the Mongol, the Tibetans, and the Muslims, which included both Chinese-speaking Muslims and Turkic-speaking Muslims. So this was the union of five races that was conceptualized. And then in the 1930s, partly as a result of the Japanese invasion of China, the emphasis on a certain kind of inalienable unity of China came to the fore. And that was argued in terms of that all the different races and nationalities living in China are genetically interconnected. The Chinese Communist Party that then eventually ousted the nationalists had a slightly different take on that, borrowed from, appropriated from Soviet ideas of managing difference. So the Soviets in the early 1920s had reimagined, reconfigured the former Russian Empire as a federation. So the Soviet Union was a union, a federal union of national republics that enjoyed territorial autonomy. Partly the Soviets sort of told them in the 1920s when they had influence over them that this would be a good idea to, through which to manage China's national diversity. And so in the beginning, there was this sense of recognizing different nationalities. And now there's the Han, and there are 55 other officially recognized nationalities, or Minzu is the term, is the Chinese term for that.
Excuse me, how many?
55, of which the Uyghurs are the second most populous. And some of them are tiny. They number only in the tens of thousands. But the official rhetoric is that China is the great unity of 55 plus one, 55 plus the Han. And there was established a system of autonomy, but and here's the difference, that China never became a federation. So China remained a unitary state in which this territorial autonomy was then much more circumscribed than in the Soviet case.
So break that down for us. Why is that important? Why is that difference of how to deal with national differences important?
So Russia was a multinational empire, and when the Russian Revolution happened, all the non-Russians rebelled often in the name of their nations, and they wanted a rearrangement of the Russian state to secure national autonomy. And so the Bolsheviks, well, beat back most of the nationalist movements, but then as a way of co-opting the appeal of the nationalist programs, they came up with this idea of Soviet autonomy, or autonomy within a Soviet system. And that guaranteed language rights. So Ukraine was the land of the Ukrainians, and Uzbekistan was the land of the Uzbeks.
And therefore, there must have been so much less clamoring for separatism, a resistance.
And there's a way in which Sovietness and Uzbekness could coexist, because Soviet ultimately was an ethnically neutral phenomenon.
Which Chinese is not.
Does not work in China.
Okay.
The other thing that happened in this, especially the post-Stalin Soviet Union, was the rise of political elites that were ensconced in the Communist Party and the Soviet apparatus that belonged to all these various non-Russian nationalities.
So governance was inclusive.
There was inclusive that Uzbekistan was run by an political elite composed largely of Uzbeks, and who could then find a place in a broader Soviet community for themselves as Uzbeks. In China, that never happened. And because ultimately, China is the national state of the Chinese. So the official Chinese position today is that China is a unified multinational state. But that multinational Chinese and Han Chinese are in practice pretty much identical. And so it sees itself as the guardian, as the navigator of the Chinese nation and its territorial integrity and sovereignty. But that's defined in a way that really has very little place, increasingly less and less place for the other 55 Minzus.
So President Xi Jinping has this huge landmark initiative, the Belt and Road Initiative, and yet by its behavior with the Uyghurs, it risks alienating some of the Muslim governments that in Central Asia and beyond that it needs.
Right, and I think that's where, I mean, the two are entirely connected. The Belt and Road Initiative, that as it is currently, the name has shifted over time, but it's currently called the BRI, the Belt and Road Initiative, and that is in some ways what is behind the current campaign of mass incarceration and political re-education and surveillance outside the camps began in the autumn of 2016, which is about the time when China was getting serious about BRI. So there are two different things here. One is the more sort of intuitive question that you just asked, that how can China do this to its own Muslims and its own Central Asians when it needs the goodwill of all these other people. The other is a more realistic thing that the BRI, the Belt and Road Initiative, won't work. It's premised on China's territorial control over Xinjiang. And the way the Chinese government sees it, the Uyghurs are restive, ungrateful, disloyal as a national group. And that is something that has happened in the last 10 years.
But is that the party line that justifies mass incarceration? Or is that really the perception? Because yes, there have been uprisings and separatist mm-hmm. moments. But are they really that restive?
No. Well, the Uyghurs have not been that restive. And a lot of the restiveness has to do with unhappiness with Chinese party and government policies rather than any proclivity for religious extremism, which is how the Chinese have, since 9/11, that has become the predominant Chinese way of criticizing its critics among the Uyghurs. There was a massive riot which had nothing to do with extremism. It didn't even have anything to do with separatism. It was a sense that the Chinese government was not taking good enough care of the Uyghurs. So there were these mass demonstrations that broke out into riots in the capital of Xinjiang in Urumqi, and in July of 2009. And that then turned into basically an ethnic or a race riot where Uyghurs attacked Chinese businesses, and 2 days later the Chinese ganged up. And Urumqi is a Chinese majority city, like it's 80% Chinese. And then for 2 days, Han Chinese beat up Uyghurs. It was a race riot. It was an ethnic riot. It was terrible. It's violent, but it was not connected to fundamentalism or religious extremism or separatism.
Because their language has been banned or their bookstores are closed.
Exactly. And so that was another turning point when the Chinese government ratcheted everything up another few notches. But nothing equivalent happened in 2016 when this campaign began. And so the only reason we can figure out, I can imagine, is that it has to do with securing the province for the success of the Belt and Road Initiative.
Okay.
And the Chinese are confident enough in their soft and not so soft power over other, over all their neighbors, that they can imagine that no one will say anything.
So the, so economic leverage.
It's economic leverage. The Belt and Road Initiative also means massive Chinese investment in all these countries, which then renders them less and less likely to criticize anything. And there have been actually some pretty unhealthy things happening where in Kazakhstan, the Kazakh government, which has a large Uyghur diaspora community, where the Kazakh government has been locking Uyghur critics of China up, on some occasions actually deporting them back to China. So that is another one of those things where all this talk of Muslim solidarity sometimes founders on the shores of reality, and this
right because no Muslim countries have there. No. 22 countries signed a letter.
Yeah, no, I know. This is
to
all
the UN High Commissioner, and none of them was
yeah.
Muslim.
I'm not this, and this is, this is one of those moments where if people seriously thought about it in Muslim countries, they will sort of figure out the shallowness of some of the rhetoric of Muslim unity, but people find ways of looking past these things. I grew up in Pakistan, which has a very odd but very old friendship, a deep friendship with China, which...
And Pakistan also borders...
And Pakistan borders China. It's actually,
but Xinjiang, too.
And it borders Xinjiang, yes.
Yeah.
It doesn't actually... It only borders Xinjiang, not mm-hmm. the rest of China. And that friendship comes out of Cold War considerations, that the Soviets were very good friends with India, so their rivals, the Chinese, had to be very good friends with the rivals of India. It's a very odd friendship in many ways, because at the height of the Cultural Revolution, when China was radically egalitarian and socialist, Pakistan was ruled by a military government, which was also very good friends with the United States. So since the beginning, that friendship has been very odd, but Pakistan is also the country where the plight of Muslims elsewhere in Kashmir or Palestine has a lot of traction in public discourse, but somehow the Uyghurs are totally exempt from all of that.
Well, you're a historian,
mm-hmm.
so can you take a long view and also project how this might work itself out?
Well, not given to optimism, so mm-hmm. This could be bad.
Is it possible to sinicize an entire population that's millions strong?
Unless you do, I would say no, and I would say that anyone would think that treating people's, the rhetoric for all this political re-education is that being Uyghur is almost a mental disease, and what these camps will do is wash out their brains. This is terminology that's actually used. And you'd think that people realize that is just doesn't work.
It also might radicalize people.
And if anything, that, yes, exactly. So here, you asked for the long view. The long view is that in the 250 years that Xinjiang has been part of the same state as the Han Chinese, the pendulum has swung many different ways many times. What is different now is, as recently as 1980, Xinjiang was a vast space far away that was difficult to control, difficult to access. Since 1980, China's economy has grown maybe 45 times. And that has given the Chinese state capacities that its predecessors, its ancestors, could never even dream of. And so that is part of, I mean, this is what fuels, these great new capacities are what fuel this ambitious Belt and Road Initiative to remake all of Eurasia. It also fuels this idea that maybe we can finally solve the Uyghur problem once and for all.
By making them no longer
By sinicizing them. So there has been the demographic sinicization of China, of Xinjiang, sorry. That's been going on since 1949. When in 1949, the Han Chinese accounted for 6% of the population of Xinjiang. Right now, they're about 45%. Almost the same number as the Uyghurs. There's this demographic flooding of Xinjiang that's been pursued as an official policy.
Well, related to that, I read somewhere that, I can't remember how many millions of children or 500,000 children have been separated from their parents. And yeah, is imprisonment in these camps a way of limiting population growth as well? Do you think?
And engineering the offspring, so that these children who are separated then go to state-funded, state-run orphanages where they are taught only in Chinese and taken away, removed from their culture and their religion. So yes, these are all pretty far-reaching kinds of policies.
As we follow this story, what is it that you would like people to keep in mind or to know or to remember even as we're getting news reports?
That's a very good question. And then many things, I suppose I could say. One is that we do tend to think, and this is in some ways the great victory of Chinese governments of the 20th century, we do tend to think of the land, of the current boundaries of the People's Republic of China as somehow natural, as being equivalent to China itself. When the fact is that in many ways the People's Republic of China occupies the territory of the Qing Empire, which was an empire of conquest just like the Russians or the Ottomans or the British or the French. And the fact that within that there are these enormous differences between various Chinese citizens, and that ultimately the Uyghurs and the Chinese state have very different understandings of what Xinjiang is. For the Chinese state, it has always been part of China since the Han Dynasty, if not before, and it's part of a single country. For the Uyghurs, it's their land, their ancestral land that is under foreign occupation. I think it's as basic as that. And the Chinese state has in the past been more conducive to recognizing that. It has never been overly generous, but it has done better in the past. What we are seeing right now is, of all the pendulum swings, this is the farthest the pendulum has swung, and has swung so far that it might not come back.
Well, that is a sobering thought indeed. Thank you so much for all the insight and background and context that you brought to us, Adib.
Well, thank you very much.
This episode of Trending Globally was produced by Dan Richards and Jackson Cantrell. Our theme music is by Henry Bloomfield. I'm Sarah Baldwin. Thanks again to the China Initiative and the Center for Middle East Studies for co-hosting this episode. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. If you like what you hear, leave us a rating and review on iTunes. It really helps others find the show. For more information about this and other shows, go to watson.brown.edu. Thanks for listening, and tune in 2 weeks for another episode of Trending Globally.